Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What was life like for your ancestors during the wars that shaped our history? Ancestry.com.au might be able to help you find these answers. I use Ancestry all the time to make Forgotten Australia episodes about life during wartime. Whether it's RAAF pilot Jim Brough, one of Australia's first masters of the air, or nursing sister Ellen Savage, who was so brave after the sinking of the Centaur, I rely on Ancestry's collection of records to help me bring the past to life. I'm always delighted by the amount of detail to be found. Names, ranks and serial numbers are just the beginning. There are also birth and marriage dates, addresses and occupations, physical descriptions, photos and signatures, and so much more. All discoverable in original documents that are digitally available at my fingertips. These are the very same resources that you can use to tell your family stories. Ancestry has the world's largest online collection of genealogical information. There are more than 40 billion records, and new records are being added all the time, so fresh discoveries are always possible. To help get you started, Ancestry is offering free access to all military records from Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom until the 26th of April 2024. There could be more to your story. Piece it together with Ancestry. Registration required and terms apply.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Oh, that looks beautiful to me, anyway.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
It's the 21st of July 1969, and 17-year-old Robert Brand is at Technical College in Sydney watching Neil Armstrong step onto the moon. But unlike all the other students gathered around the television, this teenager's recent stint doing work experience has actually played a small part in ensuring those historic images are being successfully beamed around the world. I'm Michael Adams, and this is Forgotten Australia in Conversation. We often overhear intriguing snippets of conversation, and this is what happened to me a few months back in the car park of my local shopping centre when I heard a man who was standing near my vehicle say something along the lines of, "I'm one of the few people who can say they've single-handedly saved a space mission." Unsurprisingly, I couldn't let that go, and so I introduced myself to the man who turned out to be Robert Brand. Now 67, Robert has been involved in the space sector for half a century, and he and I spoke in his home in the Blue Mountains on the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. So, where were you when man stepped on the moon?
Well, I was back in class.
What class was that?
Okay, I was working at the DCA, Department of Civil Aviation Training School, and learning to be a technician.
And whereabouts was that?
That was at Waverton in Sydney. So it was a very, very enjoyable time in my life because I'd had a rough time getting bullied at Sydney Boys High in the 60s, and then I went on, joined OTC, the Overseas Telecommunications Commission at the time, and they put me into 4 years of training, the equivalent of TAFE, equivalent of the electronics and communications course really, and we learned a lot about civil aviation systems, which actually is helping me these days.
And how old were you at this point?
Well, I joined when I was 15.
You
because
joined?
I had left school at the equivalent of year 10. It was fourth form at the time. And bullied right out of school, but I never blamed myself. I always blamed the bullies.
What sort of bullying was it?
Just non-stop. The whole year, in fact, was involved. with the exception of only a couple of people. And that was simply because the bully of the year picked on me, of all people, and just that was it. No one wanted to cross him. And so it was very isolating, I guess.
Were you a good student, science, maths, that sort of thing?
I started to be. And by the end, no, I wasn't so good.
Because
still got an A in science.
Because of the bullying?
Yeah, yeah. It's very... it stops you wanting to do anything to do with school.
So you went out of school because of the bullying and then went to tech?
Yeah. And I had 4 years, extremely wonderful 4 years, because there was just none of that. It was just good friends and good time, and I just soaked up the telecommunications. And without even studying, I managed to finish second in the year.
And what were you learning? What sort of things?
There was the odd valve involved, because that was the technology of the day back in the mid-60s. Transistors, there wasn't much in the way of integrated circuits. So everything we learned was really at the very foundation level of now what makes a computer. It's just they've got billions of transistors in them these days rather than one or two.
So it's winter 1969. NASA's about to launch the Apollo 11 moonshot. What are you up to?
Well, it was a term break. And in the term breaks, they sent us to different stations and different places in the stations so that we could get field training, so that we knew what we were doing practically.
These are the OTC stations.
That's right. And I was sent to the chief station, the good, really good place in my view, where everything was happening. And in fact, they were on the floor I was assigned to installing the NASA Control Center for Apollo 11.
And whereabouts was that?
That was at Paddington. And I grew up in Paddington. In fact, I was living at Paddington at the time, so it was a really easy one for me.
Handy.
Yeah, very handy.
But you were really in the right place at the right time.
Well, I was. It was an area I thought, this is good. And in fact, I got to choose Paddington later on when I graduated, because if you do really well, they let you choose where you want to go.
So a lot of us, when we do work experience, we're stocking shelves or photocopying something for a superior. What were you doing, and what role would it play in the Apollo 11 story?
Well, they probably had me photocopying stuff and putting things on shelves too, but at one stage there, something unfortunate happened and a lot of gear in the control room got blown up. And all the people that protected that room and wouldn't let anyone in were in dire straits, because instead of the room being finished, it was, my goodness, we have to start again and get all this new gear and power systems and everything else back online. They found out that I was involved in amateur radio, and they said, okay, Robert, you can terminate cables into this room, please, and start terminating while we do the work of buying and shipping and freighting all the stuff from all over the world to get this operational again.
So when you say terminating cables, what does that mean?
Well, putting connectors on cables, wire wrapping terminals and all sorts of things, soldering. So there was a lot going on in that room, even though it seemed to be doing just a couple of simplistic jobs.
What was that room's role in the Apollo 11 mission?
Its role was, because there was only one satellite TV channel available to the US, we couldn't feed both Parks and Honeysuckle Creek's feeds over to the US, so that the US could choose which one to use for the mission broadcast around the world.
And when you say feeds, you mean?
TV channels, effectively, I guess. Yeah, so NASA was staffing the room during the actual mission, and they had to choose which feed to send to the US, because there's only one channel free on the satellite. The feed that we sent back to the US was available, and the only other feed on the satellite was the feed that the US then sent to the rest of the world. And that's the Pacific Ocean satellite. There was also the Atlantic Ocean and all sorts of things. Lots of stuff was happening around the world at the time, but this was purely the link between Australia and the US. Basically, just a room that was manned by about two or three people, sitting at a NASA control desk, like you see at Mission Control, and a couple of seats around the place to be able to handle the rest of the gear and test equipment and so on.
When man landed on the moon, you were back at school?
Back at school.
Did you watch it on television?
Yes, we did. They crowded quite a few of us into a room. I suppose the whole of the school was in the room, plenty of people.
How did you feel?
Well, I felt pretty happy that I was actually, I'd done the wiring that had completed that link. It wasn't anything magnificent. I mean, it was terminating cables. That's what I was doing anyway.
Just a small part.
It was what I was doing anyway, but it was for this mission. And I really can't tell you how inspiring that has been to me in my life.
So how did that involvement, small as it was, in Apollo 11 change your life forever?
Well, it led me to get involved as much as I could in more of the space missions. We covered every space mission, including secret US launches. And although there was more of a hands-off approach to the missions, there were things that happened like Apollo 13 where other circuits had to be got up very quickly and extra care being taken on everything.
For those who don't know, what happened with Apollo 13?
Now, Apollo 13, as it left Earth and was on the way to the moon, it had a small insulation fault inside an oxygen tank. And to stop all the oxygen sort of pooling at one end as a liquid, they stirred it up with a little fan that was inside. Unfortunately, a spark occurred with the broken insulation. It had been there for years earlier, and they just happened to install that tank in the Apollo 13 capsule. And if it had gone into Apollo 11, it would have blown up, luck of the draw. And it blew the side out of the service module, oxygen tank 2, I think it was. And it's a wonder that they ever got home, but they were on the verge of dying and they had so many problems to solve that they only just solved the last one in time to be able to get to land. Otherwise, they would have not had the power to turn on their computers and get themselves aligned and everything.
So you were listening to this play out over the radio?
That's right. Whenever we were on duty, we'd have the volume up on this thing and we did very little work otherwise, and we were just listening to this the whole time, fingers crossed type deal.
Must have been terrifying.
For them, yeah.
Anxiety inducing.
A little bit
you.
Of anxiety, yeah. Look, it wasn't too bad. I mean, it's you want them to come home and everything else, but you've got to realise, and I think I realised at the time, this is just one of many potential ways people can die. And,
sure. So, but it must have been extraordinary, I mean, almost eavesdropping on these blokes as they sort of fight for their lives hundreds of thousands of miles away.
That's right, it was. But, you know, I try to keep things in perspective so that I can actually continue to work and operate.
Sure, sure.
You know, you hear people say, if they're in the middle of a war, for instance, you know, someone gets hurt and you say, don't focus on that, you know, focus on what you've got to focus on. Deal with that later. So when we're at work, we do what we had to do. And yes, it's not the only time we've been involved in life-saving type activities. You know, people in Antarctica have died while we've been having to listen in because we were holding up, you know, HF radio circuits to Antarctica, so that all the doctors can try and help save this person. I think I was actually more emotionally involved in that than the Apollo, because now these are Australians that were in trouble. So, you know, there was a distance between the astronauts and that, but you just wanted to do what you had to do to help.
Now, Australians probably know of our involvement with the Apollo missions from the film The Dish. Tell us how accurate or otherwise that film is, and what's your take on The Dish?
Just this morning I had to respond to someone about, they had published something on Facebook about the Dish. It's a comedy, a true story, and I thought, no, let me pull them up right then and there. No, it's not a true story. It's got some truths in it, but we did not use Parks to get the Armstrong feed of him stepping onto the moon. That came from Honeysuckle Creek, the NASA station that was designed to do that. But Parks was a dish that was had almost six times the signal strength, because instead of a 30-metre dish, it's a 63-metre dish. So you've got 5.5 times the surface area to gather the signal and point it into the focus point where there's an antenna in there. And that meant that they're bound to have a better picture quality. So everyone was waiting for parks to come online, but Honeysuckle Creek did take those first steps. So that bit in the movie is absolutely ridiculous. And they were not a bunch of bungling fools either.
So what did the dish get right, if anything?
About the only other truth was that the windstorm was there, and the staff at Parks stayed in that dish when it could have under the dish in the control room, when it could have collapsed around them, because some of the wind strengths were massive and they should have put the dish into stow in the horizontal mode, pointing straight up, to offer the least wind resistance. And they didn't. They stayed on track, which is pointed 30 degrees off the horizon, so the wind had the greatest chance of ripping the whole thing down around them. And I truly believe they're actually more at risk than the guys on the moon, because this thing, you know, it's a huge monster. Anyone who knows about sailing will know the strength of the wind on a sail and how it can push you, capsize you easily if it's strong enough. And this was a great windstorm that happened.
So this is Parks that's not going to end up taking the feed, but is in position to do so. Is that right?
Well, it can't take the feed at this time because it can only point 30 degrees above the horizon. It can't go any lower because the dish is so big that it will touch the ground.
Yep.
So 30 degrees is about 1 meter off the ground on the edge of the dish. They were ready to take it as soon as the moon rose high enough, and it was getting close. But Armstrong did step out onto the moon before Parks was ready to take the feed. It didn't have a signal.
So that's why Honeysuckle took it. Is that right?
That's right. And even then, they wanted to switch to Parks as soon as Parks did get the signal. But there was a great dispute amongst the NASA staff about whether they should. One wanted to, the other guy didn't. There was a bit of tension almost to the point of physical intervention, I'm told. That's how tense it was in the room, because one wanted to go because the signal was so much clearer. The other didn't, because the windstorm might blow the big dish right off track and leave them with nothing for a moment, and then they'd have to scramble and press switches to get it back. And they finally did switch over to Parks, and it was clear and everything else, ready for Buzz Aldrin to step on the moon. So as a movie, the dish is funny. And that's about it. The other funny thing about the dish is they were just, for a comedy, they were so intent on getting the paint colours right. Had to be perfect on the whole layout. They used a lot of the spare equipment from the day, the spares to redo the whole of the room in all the original equipment. So it's still the right desk with the right equipment. It wasn't just a mock-up thing. But why? I don't get it personally when the whole story is wrong.
Do you think Australians appreciate the role that we played in the Apollo program?
So I think it's a forgotten story, because you've got to realise it's been 50 years and more than half the population has been born since then, and they don't have a clue. They never lived through it. They wouldn't know what was done. If anything, they'd probably go, Australia, what did they do?
Would NASA have been able to put man on the moon without Australia?
They would have used Asia, but when you're wanting to choose someone that you can count on, Australia was really a good place. The Parks dish was phenomenal. It was one of the world's best at the time, and we had exactly what they needed for that.
I first met you when I overheard just a single sentence that you were saying to a friend of yours, and that single sentence was, "Not everyone can say they've single-handedly saved a space mission." My ears did prick up when we started talking, so tell me how you got into the position to save a space mission.
Okay, yeah, well, I'll just add to that. It was single-handedly save a space mission already in flight. I'm sure enough people save space missions before they got off the ground. But once they're in flight, there's very little you can do about them and very little reason for things to go terribly wrong, but they did. But that was about 30-plus years ago, and a lot happened between then and Apollo. So I'll just explain that. The missions for Apollo, the section I was stationed in covered those. We did things like start up diesel generators for power. We labelled everything. We patched circuits. We spoke on circuits. I mean, whatever was necessary. But we went on to do Skylab, and of course Skylab was a big problem because one of the giant solar panels didn't open up, and they had to go up and wrap it in a big space blanket. And all of that worked. And then back in 75, I actually went over to the US and Europe for a year, and I visited a lot of NASA sites. The family I was staying with had friends in the business. Even got to meet the president that year. Got me into one of the multi-star generals. Managed to get me into Andrews Air Force Base in the press meeting. So when the president walked down from Air Force One on his way to Marine One, he stopped for an interview with all the press, and he looked at me and said, "You don't look like the press."
This is Gerald Ford.
It's Ford. Yes, you got it right. I did respond and explained what we're doing there. But it was nice to have a little chat with the president. Not many people ever get to do that, even in the US. They go, "What? You spoke with the president?" Then we watched. We went to some of the places where they were hauling up aircraft and crashing them into the ground to see what the effect was. NASA was doing a lot of work in civil aviation at the time as well to make America strong.
So you were acknowledged by NASA for your work on the space shuttle program, is that right?
Yeah, I was received an award, a certificate thanking me for support of STS-1, Space Shuttle number one, Space Transport System number one. In fact, it was only meant to be one of three ways America would get to space, but because the budget was tightened, they never built the other two. So America was actually locked in low Earth orbit with the space shuttle, and they couldn't go anywhere for all this time. And it's only now that we're about to build spacecraft, or they are, that can get to Mars and to the moon again. So there's just been no money to go to places like the moon because the shuttle took all of it. And it wasn't quite as reliable as they expected. They didn't expect to lose two of them at all, ever. In the preparation for STS-1, I had done a lot of work personally, additional work, and I was singled out on that one to receive the award, where normally they awarded these things to the section or the station. But I did receive that personally from John Young, which was really good. One of the moonwalkers, the first moonwalker I actually ever met. I did see Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins in their Sydney parade. And, you know, they're like, you never think you're going to meet these guys. Never. They're up there. You were down there as a little technician.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So when was it that you saved the space mission?
So it was 1986 or thereabouts when I was still with OTC, and I wasn't working in the section that looked after space anymore. I'd been sent somewhere else, but I did have a reputation of being able to deal with these things in a unique way. And ESA, the European Space Agency, at Parkes was looking after the Giotto mission, and they were on site for a long time in preparation for it. And because Voyager was on one side of the solar system and the Giotto spacecraft that ESA had launched, was on the other, they were handling the mission 24 hours a day, the two missions. They'd switch from one to the other and track one and then track the other and so on. And as the Earth turned, someone else would do the tracking as they finished. And it was the Giotto probe that was going to go into Halley's Comet and get as close as it could to Halley's Comet and take photos and measurements and everything else. A lot of other spacecraft had tried to go there and blown up because they didn't have a good enough shield. But ESA was able to get further than Japan, Russia. I think Russia lost two probes and the US. So everything was going really well, except the circuits they had were failing, according to them, and they were blaming OTC, as the circuits getting back to Darmstadt had just weren't there. They just vanished as far as it electrically was concerned. So I was suddenly tapped on the shoulder to go pack some gear and go out there and expect to spend a week there. And I gathered up my gear, including this little box over here, which I built. This was a portable control room in a box. It actually was in line on the day of the encounter later on, which it served well, put it that way. It's a rarity to have home-built equipment in a space mission, and it handled all of the communications so we could talk across data circuits and send tones and receive levels and all sorts of things.
What was the problem with Giotto and how were you going to solve it?
Well, Giotto itself was fine, but it was the equipment that ESA was using that I decided was the culprit. And in fact, they should have checked this out. They should have checked it out a dozen times. And unfortunately, from what I can tell, ESA had made a bad decision not to help these people psychologically. Being out in the middle of a sheep paddock, it's mentioned in the movie The Dish, being out in a sheep paddock a long way away from the Parks Township and being stuck with each other for a long period of time, for a year, was not good. And the team decided that having a few drinks every now and again might ease the pain, having they disintegrated a little bit, and they hadn't really been doing their job very well. So I stepped in and said, I can't fault these systems. I want to have a look at your gear. And I said, I'm not allowed to touch it, but you just put that unit over there into self-diagnostic mode. And sure enough, failure. It was a packet switcher. It switched all of the circuits from one big data circuit into several voice circuits that you could send overseas. The other end reassembled it. The issue was that no one had done this test. And I just said to the guy, you know, I worked 24 hours straight. And prior to that, I'd had 8 hours off. And when I first got there, I worked 36 hours straight. I mean, it's the sort of thing they used to do in submarines when they were being attacked. He just didn't sleep. And it was a very difficult time. And I just said, okay. I said to the boss, I've discovered the problem. It's in your equipment over there, in which case I got verbally slapped in the face and told to go back to Parks and just wait at the hotel, and that I was an absolute idiot. Of course they would have checked all of this. It took 3 days. They sent up a senior engineer from Sydney, a good friend of mine over the years, Paul Kirkin, who's passed on by now, and he... He was an undersea cable specialist and unfortunately knew nothing about space or what I was doing or anything, actually. It was a case of, he said, tell me all of the problems, and they weren't as simple as I've just said. And he went into the meetings, engineer to engineer, with ESA. For 3 days they had these meetings. Then I was called back and I thought, oh dear, what are they going to say now? You know, I know the reality of this and I hope they get it right. I get called back, no apology, and I'm thinking, oh, they haven't started with an apology, this looks bad. But the head of the mission basically said, Robert, You've been seconded to the ESA mission. You're now part of ESA for the time being. And your job is to make sure my staff don't do anything stupid like that again.
If you hadn't saved the day, what would have been lost?
It was the main data going back from the spacecraft to Darmstadt, the European Space Agency headquarters.
So this is data that the Giotto is collecting about Halley's in the closest ever approach?
Everything, even pictures. So all of it would have not made it back. But they did have these big reel-to-reel tapes where they were saving the backup. Now, I was quite diligent in working out all of the problems I could with the ESA equipment. I didn't just stop there. And I got them to check all sorts of things, including the driver on the tape unit. Basically, the software that underpinned the big tape machine they had was not the latest. And it was known to fail under heavy load conditions. So it would have been fine the whole time until they actually got to the point where they were sending back all these pictures and the bandwidth just went through the roof. And it could have failed. Definitely could have failed. So they lost everything for the whole mission.
So without you, we might not know what we know about Halley's.
Someone else might have saved it.
Very modest of you.
Let's say that, no, we're all pretty good at OTC. But my little box was what actually made this thing dead easy for me. And I have video of this that's online on my YouTube channel, and you can actually see that little box in the video being utilised.
What's the YouTube channel called?
Robert Brand.
It's very on brand of you, Robert. So Giotto was over 30 years ago.
Yes.
And you've been involved in space since then?
Very much so in the last 10 years. But after Giotto, I think the Ariane rocket blew up. The US had lost a shuttle, and there was a big number of years that nothing happened. And I sort of ended up then drifting off doing other things. I was doing a lot of physical things. I was, I suppose, one of those people that did every crazy sport in the book. I'd be jumping off all sorts of places, like the Great Australian Bight, down exploring caves on the cliff line, and then climbing back up, being attacked by sea lions and almost losing my life. That was a different problem, same place though. Flying ultralight machines, put a pack on with a motor on my back and a propeller and a soft parachute type of wing, fly around the sky. There was nothing I wasn't doing. I was diving with great whites in their area without a cage or anything, pulling abalone off rocks. And
bit of a thrill seeker.
Yeah, well, of course. Caving, a bit of diving down at Mount Gambier in the sinkholes, and on it went.
So when did you get involved in the space sector again?
When I got too old to be doing all that stuff. I sort of got a real big interest again. My son was age 9, and he had shown a great interest in all sorts of things that I was doing, and I thought, this is great, okay. So I decided, as a bit of a bonding exercise, we would do what I'd seen a few people doing around the world, which was to put a balloon into the stratosphere and track it. Now, he's age 9, he's 17 now, so this is about 8 years ago when I did this bit. So we went out to a place called Rankin Springs, which is an hour's drive west of West Wyalong. So we did that, and we recovered it, and we have beautiful photos taken at 26 kilometres, over 26 kilometres. You can see sideways 160 kilometres to the Murrumbidgee River. And that's through the atmosphere, so the atmosphere is incredibly clear in Australia. You know, you talk about 10 kilometres visibility in the US as being an okay day. We've now done 40 flights, and we've recovered all 40, so we sort of hold a world record in 100% recoveries of even things we didn't intend to recover. So
footage from these balloon flights can be seen on your YouTube channel?
Oh yeah, definitely. One very good one was if you just search YouTube, MYOB and space, you'll find one that we did for revealing the new logo for MYOB, the accounting software. We revealed that at 32 kilometres altitude, almost a third of the way to space.
So you've had a little bit of commercial interest in these ballooning flights in terms of sponsorship?
Well, they cover the costs of our fun, I guess you could say.
Nice.
But we do a lot of even free ones for the Mars Society and help them out verifying some of their equipment for Mars-like conditions.
You're saying you're now moving beyond ballooning, though, in terms of...
Slightly. We are building a number of things. One of them's a stratospheric airship that is 40 metres long, if we get the money for it. But we will produce a small 7-metre long version and put it together out of bits and pieces. And if it's successful, I doubt whether we'll be having any problem getting the money for the big one.
So what would its potential uses be?
To sit in the stratosphere relaying pictures, data, radio systems, whatever's required, because it would revolutionise telecommunications. It would allow you to have a geostationary object in the sky, one that just stayed in position, very close to the ground, because to have that sort of thing in space, that's 36,000 kilometres away, and the signal levels are just, you know, impossible. We use them all the time. They're used for basically all the data and voice circuits that go via space between countries and satellites. They're that far out. All the satellite TV that we saw even back in the Apollo mission days all bounced off satellites that are out there at 36,000 kilometres from the Earth. And there's a bit of a delay. It's about more than half a second, I think, by the time it gets back to Earth again. And they'll become unnecessary in the scheme of things. You'll have, instead of satellite telephony, it'll just be stratospheric telephony.
And you could beam a free Wi-Fi signal to an entire region.
Well, these, unless there are big mountains in the way, these drones at, 20 kilometres altitude will cover around about 900 kilometres in diameter. So you'd only need about 30 to 40 in all of Australia to cover the whole country. And they can signal to each other. They can see each other in the sky. They can link up and provide all sorts of redundancy and fabulous opportunities.
And when are you planning to have the first of these, the 7-metre version?
I'd like to do it within the next 12 months, but a lot's happening. And, you know, it may be that we have to just put that aside for a year or so. But if we have enough money and enough people that are going to help, it can proceed as well. But that would be like the iPhone coming into existence. It would revolutionise communications around the world.
So you're going to the United States soon to do some tests on another project. Can you tell me about that?
Right, yes. Well, first up, I'll be going to SpaceFest to talk and... at a conference there, a major space conference, where all of the remaining Apollo astronauts will be. I will be meeting up with a lot of these people, Skylab, even Russian cosmonauts and everything. It's just a massive opportunity. And I'm one of the speakers that have spoken regularly for almost the last 10 years at that conference. So I'm very privileged to be part of that bigger picture. Now, while we're over there, we'll be launching a small rocket to about 6 kilometres. And only 6 kilometres, not into space. It's designed to carry up a test probe for an exercise we're doing for a Mars mission, which is to take a bunch of probes to Mars, jettison them from a, hopefully, NASA spacecraft that's coming into land. That's 7 minutes of terror. Yes, that's a cockatoo screaming about the 7 minutes of terror. The 7 minutes of terror, they'll eject us as part of the normal program of ejecting counterweights, and our probes will make it down to Mars and have to survive a 400 to 600 kilometre per hour impact. So we're starting to build these probes in test mode at the moment. We'll be doing some work next year at the Australian Defence Force Academy in Canberra, where we'll be using their gas gun, which is capable of firing these heavy probes at the required speed into a simulated bit of material, like a cubic metre of sand or a cubic metre of frozen sand, clay, frozen clay, rocks, frozen rocks, all of this, so that we can work out how it will perform depending on what it hits and what angles, what speed we can comfortably hit at, what angles we can hit at.
So the purpose of these probes is to survive an impact on Mars and be able to then relay data back, is that correct?
That's right, and it will be looking for methane on Mars. The Mars Median mission, which is designed by one of our team, Nick Howes, he's an astronomer and now building spacecraft in the UK. And he's basically, he invented that. He also has been the person pushing the search for Snoopy, which is the Apollo 10 lunar module. And he believes his team has found it, and NASA are sort of 98% sure they've found it. So he's been on the news very recently in the past few weeks on all the news stations.
So when do you hope that your probe might actually land on Mars?
Look, it could be 6 years away. And we need that time for all the testing that's going on, and NASA has to be very sure that we're not going to disturb their systems on the spacecraft. They don't want a free ride to Mars to be a problem for them.
When is NASA planning on going to Mars?
It's hard to say. It's not been scheduled exactly yet, but they do have a payload return mission they want to run, which will put a lander on Mars, which will have a rocket on it to send back samples from the rovers. The rovers will come and dump the sample into the spacecraft, and it'll take off again and go back to Earth. If we've discovered a methane vent, which is what the aim is, to triangulate methane that flows over with different wind directions over different probes, we can effectively then tell the rover where to go to sniff out methane. And when they do that, they should have enough density of methane to determine whether the isotopes that they find are from life or whether it's just chemical. And then you can send us the Nobel Prize in Science, please.
I hope that you get that.
I don't think so.
You never know. Well, Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and hearing your incredible history. And I wish you all the best with your future space endeavours.
I'm sure we'll talk again if I do.
Keep boldly going, sir.
I will. Thank you very much.
I'm Michael Adams, and this has been Forgotten Australia in Conversation. If you like the show, I'd love it if you could leave a review and rating at iTunes. And don't forget to check out the website forgottenaustralia.com and the Facebook page Forgotten Oz Podcast for Robert Brand's photos and videos and to learn more about other Forgotten Australia stories. This podcast was written and produced by me in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales on land traditionally owned by the Gundungurra and Darug people. As always, thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.